This talk was given at Insight Meditation South Bay. For more information and a schedule of our events, visit the Insight Meditation South Bay website at www.imsb.org. For information about online programs, visit the Bodhi Courses website at www.bodhicourses.org. Bodhi is spelled B-O-D-H-I.
Well, I'm really glad to be here and to be have been asked back again, and to be starting this wonderful series off with the seven factors of awakening, the first one being mindfulness. Mindfulness is also one of the aspects of the Eightfold Path, and like in the Eightfold Path and also the factors of awakening, they're all very interrelated. Mindfulness is so, it's also seen as the heart of Buddhist psychology. So I'm really fortunate to have been asked to give the talk on mindfulness, because it's I feel very passionate about mindfulness, and so much of what we're doing here is about mindfulness. So tonight I'll be talking about three things, beginning with what mindfulness is, and then looking at mindfulness as a way of corralling our attention and sustaining our attention, how we're able to investigate experience through mindfulness, and how insight arises through mindfulness. So it's these three pieces. And I want to begin with talking about what is mindfulness. So there's lots of different descriptions. One way to look at what mindfulness is it's a way of being practicing pure awareness. So pure awareness is being aware of the present moment in a particular way, and that particular way is with a non-judgmental stance. Because what we typically do is we have a way of saying, I like this, I don't like this, this is good, this is bad, constantly kind of categorizing experience and evaluating it. And so we tend to be extremely judgmental, sometimes noticing it, and this is judgmental to others and also to ourselves, but it's almost this sort of incessant tendency. I could be judging myself right now between my words. Am I doing a good enough job or not? You know, what are people thinking right now about this talk? So we have this filter that goes between ourselves and experience that is sort of like looking at the world through these sort of glasses that are, you know, either tinted or they have kind of a film on them, and we can't really see clearly. And so this way of paying attention to the present moment non-judgmentally has tremendous implications that go with it. What it does is it allows us to get out of this very defensive kind of position where we tend to kind of be more protective of ourselves, because we're not only evaluating our experience, but we're evaluating ourselves, and we tend to also put this overlay of personalization on what's happening. So when something is occurring, it's happening to what's called me, mine, and I. This makes things really hard. It also separates ourselves from other people and from life, and really being able to really, really be present. And so so mindfulness gives us the capacity to really get to know ourselves in a very deep way, just like in the meditation, how we were paying attention to the breath. Every time we're looking at the nuances of the breath, that way that the breath is, each breath is unique, where it's like a sort of a microcosm of our life outside. We tend to be very motivated to notice what's really obvious. So when we tune into the more subtle factors, we could be much closer to understanding ourselves and being able to be receptive to our experience. So, you know, we oftentimes notice that our mind is, you know, 1,000 miles away and our body is right here. And, well, we're either kind of in the past, sort of like this rehashing thing or this sort of rehearsing of the future. And every time we're not in the present, we can't really experience life to its fullest. So mindfulness has both the formal and the informal practices. The formal is like meditation. It could also be meditation and movement like yoga, qigong. But the informal ones are how to bring mindfulness into your everyday life. And so that when you're washing dishes, you actually know that you're washing dishes and you're not trying to like kind of get it over with as fast as possible because you'd rather be doing something else. So when you're washing dishes, you're feeling the water, you're seeing the food coming off the plate and the movement of the plate into the dishwasher. And so the implications of being present in the present moment without judgment are very vast. So mindfulness is not only this way of paying attention and having an intention to stay with the present, but it also gives us the capacity to investigate our experience. When there's all sorts of emotions that kind of cloud what's happening and these thoughts that are kind of translating what's happening or interpreting from our actually what's occurring, that we can't really investigate our experience like truly, accurately. And so when the judgment is removed and we're looking at our thoughts or we're looking at our emotions and we're seeing it from this neutral lens, then we're able to more clearly understand, you know, what is this emotion? What is this thought? Without these layers of complication that we put into it. Thoughts create stories, and the stories that we have are usually not true and kind of put you down a rabbit hole. And before we know it, we're just lost in this story. So if our mind is like over here and we're not really able to investigate, well, what is the validity, the truth of our thoughts? So in the second part of tonight, I'm going to be talking about how mindfulness investigates thoughts and also investigates feelings. And then mindfulness also has the capacity through this ability to be aware of the present in non-judgmentally and be able to investigate that insight arises. So this is called insight meditation, South Bay. Insight meditation is basically Vipassana. Vipassana means insight, and it's meditation that is an awareness practice, and it's a practice that develops insight. So it's insight into what the Buddha talks about as the three truths of reality, that's going to be the third part of this talk on mindfulness, those three truths being that we resist these basic natures of life, and we fight against them. We fight against the fact that there is suffering. There's just this inherent kind of dissatisfaction that life brings, but we resist it. Life is actually very changeable. Things are constantly sort of changing, and the only thing that's permanent is really impermanence. But we fight to kind of stamp in this sense of permanence and also kind of a permanent state. And then this third truth that Buddha is talking about is this concept that's harder to understand, but it looks like Shali is going to be giving a whole talk on it, and it's no self. We tend to have this feeling that we are this kind of fixed self that's basically a series of like assumptions and interpretations of who we are or who we should be. And this also is this filter that we put between our experience and ourselves, so that when something's happening, it's happening to me minor or I. And this is where the personalizing of life comes from. And so it's this resistance to the fact that actually we're this ever-fluctuating flow of experience that causes a lot of problems. So again, this mindfulness brings us the ability to stay in the present moment in this particular way. So it's a way of corralling our attention. It gives us the ability to investigate truly what's happening, and it develops insight. So let's start with the attentional focus. The reason why we had the meditation on the breath is that if you go to like the series, the IMSB series of how to meditate, there's five weeks. There's a very kind of traditional series that Insight Meditation teaches meditation by. And so there's an anchor of your attention, and that anchor always starts with the breath. So, the second one is on the body, and then it's thoughts or emotions, thoughts and then emotions. And then the fifth is sometimes on quality of attention, which I'll describe later. So the breath is this, it serves as the anchor to the present moment. And so why the breath? The breath is always with us. Wherever we are, we can, like I was saying in the informal practice of mindfulness, it's how to be aware that your mind is elsewhere and to bring it back. And so the breath is always there as a resource to just tap into. I know that every time I go to the dentist, which I don't like to do, here goes judgment. I'm going in there with this kind of judgmental position of this is going to be really unpleasant. But something that I will always rely on is the breath. So when anything is unpleasant happening, is happening like the drilling, I'll really like focus on the breath and put my attention right here with it, as opposed to putting the drilling on the side. So just like what we were doing in meditation of the breath, the instructions, you know, there was the sound of the siren. So yeah, the thing, you know, other senses will come and go, sound, body discomfort, but it's being able to bring our attention to where we want our attention to be. And in this case, when we're practicing meditation of the breath, it's right on the breath. And if anything is happening outside in everyday life that's uncomfortable, it's to the breath. And also, just to stay present, regardless of what's happening. It's being aware of the breath as you're doing whatever it is that you're doing. So I had also talked initially about about kind of being in defensive mode, and because we do tend to personalize experience, and things are happening to us, and we have this aversion. You know, we want things to be how we want them to be. We don't want them to be how we don't want them to be. So we want this sort of state that really doesn't exist, or certainly doesn't exist for very long, because things are constantly changing. And so the breath gives us the capacity to actually, one of the things that it does is it starts the relaxation response. So we have the stress response also that's initiated through the breath, but it's the chest breathing, and it's that inhalation, and it just kind of gets stuck there. And so if you might remember like 9/11, if you think about the very first thing that happened, if you really kind of go all the way back, it was the breath, and it was that shock. So the way that the stress response stays on is this chest breathing. It just stays short and shallow, and it kind of keeps us on low-grade kind of red alert. But the relaxation response is also initiated with the breath, but it's that deep breath that goes into the belly, so the belly expands on the inhalation and contracts on the exhalation. And within a very short amount of time, the relaxation response is turned on in the brain, and it cools down the nervous system. So while relaxation is not the point of meditating, it becomes an outcome. So when we're relaxed, we're much more able to be in a peaceful state, and the brain operates better in a peaceful state. So what happens in meditation is meditation is like the vehicle. It's like the training ground. So one of the phrases that you might have heard is like train the brain. Meditation is this kind of practice arena where we can train the brain to kind of just stay put. So it's focusing on the breath. And in the other classes, that sequence of the meditation, the next practice is focusing on the body sensations. But in this one, it's anchoring our attention with the breath. And so as we're staying with breath, we're, as I was saying in the practice, cultivating all sorts of qualities. So the mind wanders. Well, what's happening? We're noticing that the mind has wandered. So at that moment of realization, you're being mindful. And it's just sort of a given that we're, you know, unless we're in a state of enlightenment, some of the time we're just going to be not mindful. In fact, I think I heard some sort of percentage on it, and it's something like 49.3% of the time we're practicing mindlessness. So every time you notice that the mind has wandered, you just say, you put a label on it, because that helps to kind of target it. And so you say something like thinking or wandering. You might even get a little bit more specific and start kind of noticing, planning, or rehearsing or worrying. And then you start kind of noticing, the mind pretty commonly gets into this sort of state of worry or whatever it is. But initially, it's just helpful to put a mental label, thinking. And then when you come back, you're cultivating, non-judgment, because this is a practice of non-judgment. So even if you're judgmental, then you notice, being judgmental, non-judgment. So you're also cultivating patience and non-striving. We do a lot of striving in our life, or trying to get places. And so there's all of these qualities that get cultivated in this practice that could be, you know, if the hardest part is really establishing a practice, but just kind of go with 5 minutes, and then you kind of build up from there. But even in a 5-minute practice, you get 5 minutes of training the mind to be where you intend the mind to be. And that's really great, because you want to be able to trust yourself and trust that you know how to, like, basically, like, settle and be where you want to be. And then it's this whole thing of just keep coming back, keep coming back. So another phrase that's used is beginning again, or beginning anew. And the implication here is that so much of this is about being able to say yes to life, so that when you fall down, you know, it's not about not falling up. It's really about not falling down. It's really about just getting up. So there is no success and failure in mindfulness. It's all really here for the learning. And it's just practice. So the next piece of mindfulness that that's considered a foundational practice, like the breath, is the body. And so the body is how we ground our attention. And this is kind of what I was saying at the beginning. So really notice your posture and invite the posture to embody the attitude that you want to bring into the meditation. In mindfulness, it's considered an embodied practice, which means that everything happens from the body. And so it's rather than putting your kind of thoughts in the forefront, your thoughts, emotions, and your experiences are coming through the body. What they say is that the body is more reliable than the thoughts that we have, because the thoughts create these stories that, you know, as I was saying, really lead to trouble. But the body is a reliable source. It doesn't lie like thoughts. And these stories in particular can lie to us. And so we tend to really use the body to ground ourselves in the present moment and be able to get some distance between our where we are and our thoughts that could be way over here and really complicated this situation. So one of the informal practices to use the body is something that I learned through mindfulness-based stress reduction. It's called the STOP practice, and it's an acronym. For S is stop, T is take a breath, O is observe, and P is proceed. And so this is one version of all mindfulness practices, which are really about stopping, observing, and then continuing from that mindful place. So P is proceed. Yeah, stop, take a breath, observe, proceed. So I thought we would just do a really brief stop practice right now, so that you can experience this and also take this home with you. So just close your eyes and the first thing to do is S is stop. So we're just stopping. And then T is take a breath. So the take a breath is really take in 2 to 3 conscious abdominal breaths. Sometimes it's helpful to breathe in through your nose deeply. So it really goes into your abdomen, and then breathing out through your mouth and letting go of the tension. And what we want to do here is potentially trigger that abdominal, that relaxation response, but more importantly, kind of create this distance so that we can use the breath to pause before we start with the O, which is the observe. Okay, so now observe. The first thing to observe is your thoughts. So just notice what it is that you're thinking. And without trying to like investigate or dissect or do anything with the thinking, just identify what a thought is that you're having right now, what this sort of like predominant thought. And thoughts are connected to emotions. And so the next thing to observe is emotionally, what is sort of a primary emotion that you're feeling right now? And put a label on the emotion. And now this third part of O for observe is observe your body sensations. So thoughts impact emotions, although it could also go the opposite, and emotions impact physiology. This is the mind-body connection. And so just notice what's happening in your body. If you feel any kind of points of tension, imagine bringing the breath into and out from this point of tension, making room for the sensation to kind of have more space, potentially dissolve, or just even simply be. Because just acknowledging what's there can be enough. And if you're feeling a kind of tightness that might be helped with moving the body, you know, if you feel like your shoulders are tight, maybe have your shoulders go in like circles, or you know, if your neck is tight, move your head, kind of do any sort of bending, or just breathe into or out from sensations. Just sort of notice what's happening in the body and invite any kind of release, relaxation, or letting go. And now the P is to bring this more kind of relaxed, aware state with you as you open your eyes. Okay, so just very briefly, does anyone have any questions or any comments about how that practice goes? And just one thing is that this is a really great thing to do if you're at a stoplight, because especially since this is called stop, it's sort of a good way to remember, oh, stoplight, do a stop practice. You're going to be there for 2 or 3 minutes. I don't know. I was at a stoplight today. It seemed like 5 minutes to me. Of course, I was in a rush, and so it seemed like it was longer. But the stop practice is, okay, well, I can't go anywhere anyway, but it's with my eyes open. Stop, take a few breaths, observe, okay, my thought, I'm going to be late, my emotion, anxious. And then I spent the rest of the 2 to 3 minutes in my body, relaxing my fingers, kind of moving my shoulders around. Also, even with my eyes open, being able to breathe kind of into places of tension. And by the time the light went on, I felt much more calm and relaxed. So lots of opportunities to do the stop practice. So anyone have any comments? It's a little harder to do when you're not sort of in a kind of an anxious or irritable sort of place. But anything that Any comments that anyone wants to make?
My mind didn't wander.
It didn't wander?
It did.
Oh, it did. So mindfulness is, you know, it's not so much about the why, but it's like the how. So then it's the mind wandered. So the question is, how did you work with it? So are you aware of the mind wandered, which, like I was saying in the meditation instructions, the mind will always, that's what the mind naturally does, it wanders. And so are you aware of how you responded to the mind wandering, what you did? And then are you aware of, are you aware of like that state when the mind was wandering versus when you brought yourself back and you were back into that stop practice?
I don't remember.
It's something that I notice is my mind is like, if I'm meditating, my mind is wandering, and it's usually, I'm usually not feeling terrific if the mind is wandering. It's, I don't know, it's distracted in something or another. And then I bring myself back and I feel so much, I don't know, more anchored or grounded and peaceful. And so one of the things about mindfulness is that it really, and this is the what happens with awareness, is that you really get much more in touch with in many ways what Buddha is saying, that the practice is so much about what causes suffering and how to break free from suffering. And so, you know, what is it that causes distress, and what is it that, and how can we work with it skillfully to be in a greater state of ease? So this is one of the benefits of the practice. Mm-hmm.
I was noticing planning during when I was observing, and I was thinking now, you mentioned how we bring in meditation into daily activity, and so I'm wondering if you'll be talking about, you know, maybe this is later, but how we, because obviously to function and do the things we do in life, way to be in planning mode more mindfully? I don't know.
Yeah. Well,
I couldn't tell, you know, I was observing planning, and there was a part of it that was energized, you know, something.
Mm-hmm.
It's good that I'm planning.
Mm-hmm. Right,
but sometimes I need to plant. So
yeah.
I'm curious about
sure. And are you talking about this occurring during the meditation or the stop practice?
It's right now in the stop.
Oh, in the stop. Uh-huh. Did it also happen in meditation?
I think I was really sleepy during, you mean our first?
Yeah, the 30 minute.
I was more sleepy.
Oh, okay.
In that meditation.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, it's not as though thinking is a bad thing. and also, it's not as though evaluating is not a bad, I mean, we do have to evaluate things, but we want to be in mindfully planning, and this is kind of what really you're saying, as opposed to mindlessly planning. One of the things that I notice is that my mind, when it wanders, will often go into planning. And when you start looking into, so then the first thing that you sort of notice is, oh, planning, mind wandering, planning. So then there's sort of this habit that's going on. And planning is oftentimes related to kind of anxiety, right? Because it's a rehearsing sort of thing. When you go into the future, it's more like a kind of a fearful, sort of anxious place. More the past is more kind of guilt, regret. And so as you notice planning, and that your mind is going to planning, when you are in this place of this kind of like brain training place, where you want the mind to be stable. So, you know, if you look at being effective and efficient, that if you have a stable mind and you're able to really, you know, anchor your attention, that you're not going to need to plan during meditation. So yeah, it's really, mindfulness is about attention and intention. So the intention is a big part of the practice. It's what they say about intention is it's often called like seeds. So when a gardener plants a seed, that seed will plant that very thing that he wants or she wants to plant. So that's the rose seed will grow the rose plant. And so similarly in life, if we plant a seed of worry, we'll just say, then what will sprout out of that, will grow out of that, is like sort of anxiety. And then if the anxiety seeds will grow fear, and then the fear seeds will grow kind of insecurity. And so every moment is seen to be a moment of intention. And we have a chance of planting a seed in every mind moment. So this is, again, that whole concept of beginning anew. Just keep on coming back.
So in meditation, you know, if we're going into planning, in the formal meditation, if we're planning, then we're bringing ourselves back to the breath. Awareness.
Yeah, we're bringing ourselves back. We're just noticing.
Right, noticing, and then, you know, with the intention of bringing back, coming back to the breath or whatever the anchor is.
Right.
But when you actually are intentionally planning.
Yeah, then you plan.
Then you plan, but is there a way to do it? I don't know if this is the right forum for this, but how do we do that more mindfully? You know, when we're, you know, because you said.
Yeah, okay. So this is kind of what I was saying with that fifth meditation class, is what's called the quality of attention. And so mindfulness is very much about, and I'm going to be talking more about this in the investigation, but it's not about changing what we're doing, it's changing how we're relating to it. And so we're looking at what quality our attention is that we're bringing with us. So I know that for myself, again, here's this judgmental thing. I have to write reports, and I don't like writing reports. And even as I'm saying that, I'm sort of reinforcing the fact that I don't like reports. So what I'm really working on is letting go of my resistance to the aversion of report writing. And so what I do is I have to write this report, and I'm noticing, oh, tension, what's going on in my head, I don't like, I wish this was, you know, the mind stuff, emotional, like sort of a kind of a, I don't know, sort of an anxiety. I want to get it right. And so I just notice thoughts, emotions, body. This is the stop practice that you can put in motion all the time. So, okay, so I stop, breathe, notice thoughts, emotions, body, and then it's okay, just put a different quality of attention into this. So if I was planning, if I was consciously planning mindfully, I would really be noticing the quality of attention that I was bringing into planning.
Mm-hmm. Are there times when mindfulness is undesirable, like, say, when you're in an extremely dangerous or stressful or painful situation, when being mindful would be very uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable?
Being aware of what you're feeling
would
be very uncomfortable.
Yeah, so one of the things that John Kabat-Zinn says, who is the person who introduced mindfulness-based stress reduction more than 30 years ago. He's really credited in many ways for bringing mindfulness to not only mainstream, to society, is mindfulness is not for the faint of heart. Because even though I said that relaxation is a byproduct, oftentimes a byproduct, that it can not necessarily always be. So, for example, if you have post-traumatic stress disorder, even though they're using mindfulness in some of the programs, it can be too much to really be mindful, because then you might be like just in the thoughts and then the story so vividly that that's not being mindful. But mindfulness in terms of the being present, sometimes if you're going through kind of, if you're dealing with trauma, being present can be pretty scary. But if you're, you know, if you're like in a dangerous situation, I read this story of this person who was in an avalanche. So he was one of, I think, 22 people who was buried under snow. He was one of the few people who stayed alive. And the reason why is because he practiced mindfulness. And basically what I mean by that is that he was an endurance bicyclist, and so he knew how to relate to, like, bonking. Like bonking is when you just, you know, you're riding it and all of a sudden you have absolutely no energy. So he knew how to draw upon his inner resources. And so what he did when he was buried under the snow is that he focused on his breath and he just stayed present with just being there with the breath. His heart rate went down, the amount of air that he needed was lessened, and he was able to stay in that state under the snow long enough to be rescued alive. But I mean, even like if you're in any kind of situation, not having your thoughts go with you, and your emotion, like if you're so fearful, you can just freeze. So mindfulness can give you the capacity to really be present and do what you need to do. Okay. Yeah, so, you know, what I want to do is go to how to use mindfulness to investigate thoughts and emotions, and then when I get to the emotions, I'll definitely address your question. Okay. Buddhist psychology points to the beliefs and how tightly we hold on to our beliefs that is the cause for our mental suffering. So it's not so much the thoughts we have, but actually how tightly we hold on to these thoughts. Buddhist psychology, when you look at like what is the cause of suffering, it kind of comes down to one thing. It's craving or clinging. It's clinging to what we want, clinging to what we don't want. And so the problem that we run into with thoughts is this tight hold on them. You know, things have to be how we want them or not want them. And we get, this is where, you know, just feeling fixated or obsessed or fearful comes from. It's the hold that we have that is more of the problem than the actual thought per se. So there's this story of How to Catch a Monkey in India. It's a story that's often used to talk about the tight hold that we put on thoughts. So apparently one of the ways to catch a monkey is you put a coconut with a banana, carve out the inside of the coconut, put a little hole about the size of an arm of a monkey, put a banana inside. So you string it on a tree, the monkey goes over, oh, banana, I guess they smell it or something, put their hand in, and they will not let go of the banana. So, I mean, obviously all they have to do is let go of the banana to get out, but they won't let go. And so it's a really easy way of catching a monkey. There's also oftentimes what's used for this to understand the role of thoughts from this perspective is the story of Buddha and the three arrows. So Buddha tells his students, how do you feel if you're struck by an arrow? Oh, terrible. Well, what about a second arrow? Oh, that much worse. What about a third? Oh, it's horrible, devastating. So Buddha says the first arrow is suffering, that life does bring suffering. It's unavoidable suffering. But the second arrow is, oh, you know, why didn't I move? You know, stupid me. The third arrow is, oh, I'm going to die here. I'm not going to be able to support my family. And then you can get into four, five, and, you know, innumerable arrows. So this is what the Buddha talks about as optional suffering. There's also a quote by Epictetus, Greek philosopher. He says, we're disturbed not so much by the thoughts that we have, but, we're disturbed not by what happens to us, but by our thoughts about what happens. There's also another quote. I don't know who said this one, but whatever harm an enemy may do to you, your own thoughts, stormy and uncontrolled, will harm you more. So thoughts are not seen to, I mean, it's not about getting rid of thoughts. Again, it's about learning how to work with thoughts skillfully. Really, mindfulness comes down to two questions. Is this thought wholesome or unwholesome? Because we're not being judgmental here and saying bad thought, good thought. Is it wholesome? Is it unwholesome? Is how we're responding skillfully or unskillfully? So there is that in the meditation class when the object of attention is thoughts, you actually learn how to work with thoughts, and we don't have time to go into it in detail, but I'll just simply mention that there's this practice with another acronym. The acronym is RAIN, so Tara Brock, who is an insight meditation teacher, and she's also an author and founder of another insight meditation center, popularized that acronym, but apparently it's been around for, ages. So what it means is, as you, first of all, if you're meditating and your mind just cannot get rid of this, just can't, you can't focus on the breath or the body sensation. This thought is just incessant. And so that becomes the object of your attention. And so R is recognize the thought. A is allow the thought or accept the thought for what it is. This is, again, like don't resist it. The I is investigate the thought. So the way that you investigate the thought is, first of all, label it. What is this thought? Okay, kind of a one-sentence thing. And then it's also helpful to label it with a title. And this is where it helps you kind of get some distance from the thought, because, again, we tend to personalize the thought as, like, the thought is me. And so if you find that you're having a familiar thought, like you can't do something, you might put the label of, here it is, the little engine that couldn't. Kind of think of something that's kind of cute, and you know, but also the idea is to not like your thought. It's almost like, oh, here you are again, that little engine. And so you put a label on it after you've identified what the thought is, and then you investigate. So you investigate, how is this thought impacting my emotions? And then you look at how this thought is interacting with your body. Oh, like you can feel sort of the anxiety in parts of your body, maybe racing heart or tension in your shoulders, whatever it is. And then also the energy behind the thought. Are you clinging to the thought? Are you averse to it? You know, what is that quality again? This is the quality of attention that you have with the thought. And so you're investigating the thought in this way. And then the N in RAIN is non-attachment. So you're or non-identifying. You're not identifying that I am my thought. It's this is the thought. This is how it happens with this thought in terms of my emotional experience, my bodily sensations, and the energy behind it. So RAIN, again, is recognize, accept or allow, investigate, and then non-identify.
So non-identify means it's not me.
It's not, exactly. It's not me. I am not my thought. So if you look at what thoughts are, they're in Buddhist psychology, they're mental formations. They're like clouds in the sky. And so one of the practices, again, this is an MBSR practice, it's meditation on senses, and the thought becomes your object of attention. And you're not investigating the thought, but you're seeing the thought coming and going like a cloud in the sky. And so you're practicing not clinging to the thought. It's just like sounds come and go, thoughts come and go. And then the next is, how does mindfulness look at emotions? Well, similarly, emotions are they're wholesome or unwholesome. It's about working with them skillfully. But emotions can become destructive depending on what you do to them. So this is getting to the question about grieving. So it's how do you work with thoughts? In many ways, it's about making space for emotions. It's about making space for emotions. There is an analogy with that's oftentimes used, salt and water. So if you put a teaspoon of salt in a little cup of water, it's very salty. If you put it in a pot, it's still salty, but if you put it in a pond, you don't taste the salt at all. So this is the analogy of disturbance of the mind or of the heart will diffuse in a spacious and open heart or a spacious and open mind. And so it's making room for emotions to be there. So in terms of like grieving, mindfulness is very much about moving towards that very thing that that's hard. So grieving it's sad. There's tremendous loss. But it's the resistance that causes more pain. This is like, again, the optional kind of suffering that I was talking about. And so it's being able to recognize the emotions, give room for the emotions. And one of the practices, along with also the RAIN practice for meditation of emotions, you could do that RAIN practice, is to get to know emotions. And so you get to know, well, again, you don't identify with the emotions. It's basically, this is sadness or this is grieving. So what does grieving feel like in the body? And this also helps to put distance from being overwhelmed by it, because you're inviting it. And so if you're feeling sad, well, sadness feels like, oh, heaviness in the heart, tension in the head, or whatever it is, but you're actually getting to know the grief in the body. Now, that's not to say that there aren't other things to do. I mean, I think grief is a very active process. So mindfulness is not just about it's also knowing how to work with your thoughts, how to work with your emotions, but then what you do that also is a wholesome or an unwholesome thing to do. And so, like in the grieving process, it could be really helpful to reach out and call a friend. Maybe think of some sort of a ritual. So it's also very behavioral in seeing that cause and effect relationship. Do you want me to say anything more about it? There's okay. And then just lastly, because we're really, really kind of short on time here, is the three truths. So this is the insight that mindfulness brings. So that first truth is that there is suffering or there is dissatisfaction, but what creates more of the suffering is our resistance to it. And so the antidote is really about about bringing acceptance in. Acceptance in mindfulness means being with it. It's just being with what's happening. It doesn't really mean accepting it. It means having the capacity to just be with it. This is sort of what I was saying about making space for emotions. And so whenever you notice that you're resisting...
I'm sorry, what did you say? I really liked this. You said it's not about... You said just being with...
Oh, acceptance. The definition of acceptance in mindfulness is being with it.
Being with it.
Being with it, yeah.
It's not...
No, it's not about life. Then you're not trying to, like, get to acceptance. Because mindfulness is being in the present. And so it's just being with it. And so when you notice that you're resisting, because resistance, pain times times resistance equals suffering, is an equation from that a lot of people use. When you notice resistance, just notice resistance and then come back to the breath. And you know, just sort of settle into, okay, this is what's happening. That second truth of reality is impermanence, that everything changes, but we have a tendency to want things to stay in constant position. And so again, notice when you're resisting that law of existence. And the third one is this concept of no self. And I would really encourage you to attend Shyla's workshop, or there's another talk coming up on no self, but it's the concept of no self is that we tend to feel like there's like personalized, and so like the ego is sort of this way of assuming or kind of interpreting that we should be a certain way or that we are a certain way. And so when something happens and it collides with that, then we get offended, we feel insecure, various things happen. And in truth, according to the Buddha, that there really is no fixed or solid self. There's really an ever-fluctuating flow of experience. And so the beauty of this concept of no self is that when we can see ourselves more as a fluctuating experience without this boundary that defines who we are, then we're more able to feel a part of our common humanity. We know that we're not alone. We're much more open and available. And we recognize the fact that when it comes down to it, we are already whole and complete in all of our imperfections. We are able to recognize what's called either Buddha nature or original goodness, that at that very core place of ourselves, that we are already whole and complete, even if we feel like we're a total wreck, that our core is really is really whole. So we have maybe time for one question. Sure.
I have one. Another one.
Okay.
Is can mindfulness be helpful for, you mentioned PTSD, what about other psychiatric conditions like schizophrenia or bipolar conditions, or also for physiological or behavioral addictions?
So there's so much research going into mindfulness, MBSR, meditation. There's what they say is that there's actually more research happening than what you can keep track of. I think a tremendous amount of money is pouring into research in National Institute of Mental Health that's meditation, mindfulness, MBSR based. And it's if you look at like the different programs, there's mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, mindfulness-based eating, eating awareness training, mindfulness-based relapse prevention. So this is for addiction, sleeping, and they're looking at it for all sorts of different kind of mental challenges, including PTSD. So it is. It is being used. My husband works at the VA, and so they have a mindfulness component to their PTSD program. I don't know actually about schizophrenia, but certainly for depression, it's what's happening. incredibly effective approach, tremendous research, evidence-based now on this being a highly effective treatment. Okay, well, here it is, 9:00. And thank you so much. I think I covered a lot of ground here, and we could have had easily another hour for questions and responses. But if you have any questions afterwards, I'll be staying in. Is this the night for? Is this the night where you have tea? Oh, this isn't that night. Okay. But anyway, you're welcome to stay in and ask me anything that you might want to ask me. So thank you, everyone.